This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Thank you for listening to this episode, and thank you also for subscribing to our pod letter and to our YouTube channel. If you don't do one of those three, you should be doing them all. At least that's what most people say in my household, and it's just me living here, so that's what I say to myself. Everybody should be listening to this and subscribing to the pod letter and to the YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/texasmagician. And of course, you can get the pod letter. Just go to the magicwordpodcast.com, and there you will see where you can subscribe to the pod letter so you can get weekly updates on who's going to be on each week and who's coming up next week and suggestions from the archives and more. I also want to thank all of those people who had attended my online lecture this last week, and if you missed it, you can go back and watch it in the archives. It was sponsored by the NewMagicAcademy.com, so if you go to NewMagicAcademy.com, there you can enroll and you can watch not only my online lecture, but also those of many, many others who have been on that broadcast for such a long time. It was about a two-hour lecture that I gave with some special deals, and if you listen to that, you will have access to a special link where you can purchase some steeply discounted lecture items there. Well, anyhow, thank you, J.D. Stewart, for hosting that and letting me be a part of your New Magic Academy. And it was a heck of a lot of fun. And we had about 75 people who had attended the lecture from around the world live at the time. And if you miss it, I hope you get a chance then to watch it on the replay through NewMagicAcademy.com. Well, this week I want to introduce to you someone who you probably have seen at some time or another. He has been in the public eye for not just magicians, but I do mean the public, where this gentleman has traveled the world. This is, I'll tell you, of course, you know by now, it's Jeff Hobson, who was one of the members of the Illusionists, and they had toured the world from Sydney to Sydney, I mean, around the world, from the Sydney Opera House all the way back to the Sydney Opera House. And that little reference will come into play later in this podcast when you hear Jeff talk. But beyond that, of course, he was known for a long time as the host of Las Vegas, where he was the perennial master of ceremonies and someone who everyone loved to have on their show. Also, in Magic Magazine, he was listed as one of the top 10 funniest magicians who were living at the time, which included Penn and Teller and Michael Finney and Johnny Thompson and Pam and a few others. It was just he was just a very funny guy and recognized again by magicians and public alike. And he has now settled in La Quinta, California, where he has Marvin's Magic Theater, which of course is named after Marvin Roy, who was Mr. Electric. Well, I'm going to let you hear all of that in his own words. So please welcome my friend here this week, the host of Las Vegas, Mr. Jeff Hobson. Today I have with me a very special guest, someone I have known for a long number of years. We were just chatting beforehand, and he said about 35 years, and that sounds about right. About sometime, I think, perhaps in the 80s, perhaps when we first got together and played some golf and hung out at the Magic Island here in Houston, and have been friends and see each other on his spectacular and astronomical rise to the level where he is then right now, which he is. I've always referred to him as Mr. Las Vegas, but he's living in California, which makes no sense to me right now. Well, actually, it will when we kind of get into all of this conversation. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Jeff Hobson. Hi there, Jeff. How are you, man?
Oh, wait. Oh, I hear the applause now.
Here it
sorry,
is.
Oh, sorry. That's me.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Zen applause. One hand clapping. That's what that is.
Exactly. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing fantastic. So good to see you. Yeah, as I said, you've always been Mr. Vegas, and then you went out to California. I know, you, of course, in between there was the Illusionists and World Tours and all kinds of stuff that you had done, being the MC for Las Vegas. I really, boy, as I said, you know, kind of going back to the Magic Island days, and you were performing then. That had to be, I want to say, maybe 88, 89, somewhere in there-ish.
I think I started with about 87 and did a few different years, came back subsequent seasons there and did a few weeks there. It was always fun. I loved it. And, of course, Hollingsworth, you did the interview with him, and the lecture was fantastic. I love that. I haven't seen him in so long, and it was like a little reunion in my head. I loved the Magic Island, both the one in Houston and the one in, was it Laguna Niguel or something like that?
It was in, oh, golly, now that you said that, I want to say like Long Beach. It was not Santa Monica.
It was near San Diego-ish. It was down that way.
It was. Let me ask you a question. I was a house magician there, the one in Houston. What is the difference between the two of those? Although being owned by the same place, but.
Yeah, well, you know, here's the thing is that, you know, as we all know, the Houston one was a pyramid and built from the ground up, you know, whereas the one in California was sort of retrofitted into a regular sort of normal strip mall space. Huh. So it had a different feel to it. There was a lot of the same Egyptian motifs everywhere, the same feel with the furniture and whatnot, but it had a lot of the same pluses. And obviously the one in Houston, you know, it was bigger and had a little more, you know, tricks to it, if you would. So it was fun. Both were good, though. Both are great venues.
Yeah, I think the idea originally was for them to have some sort of a Magic Island kind of model that would be built, and it would go, they proved the success of the model in Houston, they would go to Chicago, Atlanta, and Washington, D.C. area, you know, different places, so there would be then ultimately a nice route for magicians to get booked from one place to the other throughout all these clubs and everything.
Yeah, and that was the first time I had met and worked with Jack Goldfinger and Dove. Mm-hmm. And I got the best advice. If anyone knows Goldfinger, has anyone talked to him, you know, he always, for some reason, he's like one of these geniuses where whatever he says is like a piece of gold.
He's a guru.
It's like wonderful. And he said, I was really upset backstage with something, and I was really mad or something, which I normally don't get, but I was mad at this time after a show. And he came up to me and he says, Jeff, on one hand, you got hot. On the other hand, you got cold. You got to be cool. And I just thought that was like the best. I said, you know what? The way he said it, I just laughed. And I said, Jack, you're right. And he called me right down, and we were friends ever since.
You sound just like him. I can hear him saying something like that. Whenever I speak with him, again, it's kind of like listening to a guru. I mean, he just has, he drops these little gems along the way. I talk with him a couple of times at the Magic Castle. I'm working out there. We go down to the library and we'll be talking for a little bit, and he'll say something. It's like, oh man, I just feel like just studying at his feet and not saying anything, just listen to him talk.
Yes.
A lot of really great ideas and things that he's had. Then we played a lot of golf then also, and I know like in Colon that you go and play at the Colon Open. We played partners there a few times.
Yes. Now, you know, I started that with Al Leone, and I named it originally the Open Colon.
Okay.
To a little bit of a play on words.
Exactly, which,
our own entertainment pleasure. But then eventually became the Colon Open. I said, no, the other way around is better. But, you know. So, yeah, I played there a few times. Matter of fact, I haven't played probably 20 years or more. I think I only did it three times because I was so busy doing things. I'm playing this year. I get to, you know, have a reunion of sorts. It'll be fun.
I'll be there. Maybe we partner up then again.
Damn.
Because I think the last time I might have played with Michael Finney was in my cart. And the time before that, I think it was you. So, I know this year in August is going to be just a great convention again. He always puts on, I don't know what number, 80 or something.
It's about that. Yeah, I think it's 79 or 80, whatever. But, who would have thought it would have gone, you know, still gone on as long as it has. And now, you know, Colon, Michigan was always known as the magic capital of the world. But now it sort of really is, because where can you find, four now magic companies in a quarter square mile, you know?
Just within a couple blocks of each other, basically, yeah.
Yeah, it's it is amazing.
I did, and besides that, it's a place where magicians go to die.
Yes. Yes, they do. And in more ways than one, yes.
I just set them up, man.
I've seen plenty of acts over the decades at Epson, just like any other convention, you know. You're going to have some good ones, and you're going to have some people that are going, whoa, what the hell are you even doing on stage, you know. So, yes.
Yeah, but there at Colon Cemetery, at the Lakewood Cemetery, is I know that Al has the book on the Magic Cemetery, and
yes,
he's constantly updating that. Yeah, it is a good book.
Yeah. Yeah, he. Matter of fact, he was just updating it just this past fall, so I think a new version's coming out.
It is, and in fact, he's hoping to have that. This might be a little bit of a preview. I don't know if he's announced that yet, but there should be one, hopefully, being released, I believe, at this year's convention in August there at Abbott's.
Right, that'd be great.
So, yeah, it is just a really good thing that he does, of course, with the tours and everything. It's amazing who all is there. I just recently had purchased a plot as well. I've been wanting to do that after my wife passed a few years ago. I had asked her about that, and she said, well, why do you want to go? Should we go there? Because our kids won't come. And I said, well, even if they're, you know, here in Texas, I don't think they would come necessarily regularly. Whereas here, I believe at least once a year, or people who make pilgrimages, magicians in the future, will be going by and at least reading our names, you know, at that point.
I think it'd be a great thing to keep Colon on the map, you know. That'll do it, I think.
Yeah.
So it's the more the merrier, I guess.
I guess. So I've got a plot right next to Walter Blaney and right behind Phil Wilmarth and kind of near David Linsell right there.
Yeah.
So are you thinking about going there, or you got...
You know, I haven't gotten to the point yet in my life where I'm going, you know, I want to think about where I'm buried yet.
Okay.
I'm not quite there, although my father-in-law does have four plots in southern Michigan, a family thing that he's kept in for a couple generations, and I'm not so sure. I don't know. The rest of my family's all been cremated. My uncle was that was a little bit of a sad thing. On his way to a funeral, we cremated him, had his remains. And it was in a snowstorm, and the hearse got stuck, and we had to use the ashes to get this hearse out of the stuck, you know, snow. So, yeah, it was not a good thing.
But you wouldn't be where you were without treading on Great Uncle Bob.
That's right. Uncle Bill, thanks.
Uncle Bill, sorry. Switching subject for just a minute, I want to congratulate you for being a man ahead of your time, way ahead of your time, because many years ago in Vegas, you had the virtual lectures before people were doing virtual lectures or online lectures, or for that matter, it was before DVDs. I think you still were doing just video, VCRs and everything. And you had people coming, you had a regular studio, and was it Michael? Who was it? Lorne Michaels was working with you?
Christopher Michaels, yep.
Yeah. And so you had a regular crew, and you had a lot of really great talent who had come in and done these lectures. And well before Murphy's and Penguin were even around, let alone starting to do any kind of videos. I mean, you were just – I want to say perhaps that Joe Stevens was doing his videos, but this was a different kind of a setup, because you started doing this, I think, online. So tell me a little bit about your model.
Well, it was just an idea that Lauren and I were talking about at a bar, you know, over a drink sort of a thing. We said, hey, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we could have just online lectures? Just forget about, you know, tapes and this and that and this. Anyone around the world can see it all at once, live, real time, ask questions, real time.
Yeah.
And we went, yeah, that'd be cool. So we started looking at different formats and equipment, and we actually built with our hands. I mean, sawed the wood. I mean, everything. We put up the walls, divider walls, this special drywall that was insulating for sound rooms. We put that up. We painted it all green, green screened it, and we were learning about green screen, which was very, you know, archaic at the time.
Yeah.
We had all the best cameras. We had we had five different cameras above, sides, everywhere. We had this thing called a TriCaster, which was quite a piece of equipment that allowed you, that transcoded the video to go online. And of course, the one big mistake of marketing is we didn't find out how many people were actually, able to see these and had some broadband in their house.
What year would it have been?
Huh?
What year was that it started?
This was 2007.
So, okay.
And so we found out that people had a lot of dial-up at the time, and people had small, you know, slow. But to really do this correctly, you really need to have some good you know, good speed. And I guess a lot of people just didn't have it, or they didn't know what it really was. And but we did it, and we did quite a few lectures, which actually I have now, you know, on my website. You can see them pretty much all. I'm loading them up as the years have gone by. Hobsonschoicemagic.com. If you just join up on my website, it's all free, you know, so you can see all those lectures right there. Mm-hmm. And you can see me quite a bit younger, you know, then. And it was a good thing. It was a bit ahead. However, one interesting thing was I hired this whiz kid. His name was Jeff. And I said, look, we need something. We need a super fast computer that transcodes and, you know, does all this. And funny enough, we got to the point where there was almost no latency anywhere in the world. It was like down to like almost nothing, which as now that's quite a thing to do with no latency as we are now. But years ago, it was like non-existent. You had to wait a minute or two or 10 or five or whatever it was to get up to speed. And we had Toshiba and Sony looking at us, trying to figure out what we were doing. We were in meetings with them, and they're looking at the box, and they're like, can we see inside the box? And we're like, no, you can't look inside the box. You know, it's like a magic trick. It's a secret. We're not going to tell you. Well, it was just a matter of about 2 years, and then they caught up with us, and we, you know, me about $85,000 in an investment sort of down the tubes because we just couldn't. I needed 150 subscribers, and we only got less than 100. Mm-hmm. So, you know, nowadays it would be quite different. But, yeah, we had a great time, a lot of great lectures, and they're still all available to be seen.
What would you say the guy's first name was that was helping you, that had the idea for the latency issue?
Oh, Jeff.
Well, did he go on and create Amazon? Was that Jeff Bezos? Sounds like a brilliant guy.
No, I wish it was. No, this guy was a 22-year-old kid that I just interviewed, and you know, he knew everything about computers. That was him. But no, it wasn't Bezos. It would have been. I'm missing out on a few trillion dollars here somewhere.
It just sounded like that he had such a great idea, and these companies were coming in wanting to see what he's doing, that he probably had that kind of creativity and that kind of a mind. I thought maybe he went on to some greatness like that.
We parted ways, and I hadn't seen him since.
That's interesting. Well, I remember way back then, of course, that you were getting ready to do something else. I think that was when you were starting to work with the V Show and around that time also. Is that right?
Right. I was jumping from show to show. I'd never really been out of work in Vegas. I was always, you know, whenever I moved in, you know, early 90s, a year after I was married in 92, 93, I had an offer to do Spellbound, which was at Harrah's under mm-hmm. Dick Foster Productions. And yeah, and then that show led 4 years in that show, then another 4 years at this show, then another 4 years at that. And it seemed like 4 years was the magic number for me. I always seemed to, I don't know why. And then, you know, a lot of these places, every time I left one, they'd imploded. So I thought it was me. but, you know, finally, we got to V, the Ultimate Variety Show, somewhere around right after 9/11, he started the show. So like 2001, 2002, started that show. And, I was in that show for about 4 years, mm-hmm. a good 4 years. And then I quit that show because I decided to go on to other things.
Yeah, I mentioned that because I remember coming out to Vegas at the time you were thinking about selling that concept of the lectures. And I was seriously considering doing that. And my wife was a dental hygienist. Yeah, she was going to come out. She was going to get a license to practice as a hygienist, work for a dentist. And we didn't get to the point of looking for houses, but I came out and seriously considered making the move at that time.
Yeah, and I remember us talking about that. That's right. Yeah, because I thought you'd be the perfect person to do it, too. So there you go. And now you're doing it bigger and better than what we ever had. So it's good. You're doing a good job, Scott.
Here we go. Yeah, I remember having a martini and a cigar at that fantastic hotel. It was where a lot of people hung out from the Cirque after. What was that? What's the hotel?
There's a Paris that has a great cigar bar.
No. This was a place that was late at night. These two guys had fixed up the place, and people from the Cirque and different performers would go after work, like after midnight, and hang out there at the bar. And they had all these paintings like of Van Gogh and everybody on the walls and things.
The Artisan.
That's it, the Artisan. Thank you.
Yes, which is still a boutique hotel, and that's correct. And it was quite a great – I don't even know if it's still there. It's still there, but I don't know if they still have the cigar – you know, area, but mm-hmm. that was a fantastic, I should go back and do that when I, good idea. I'm going to go back.
I just have good memories of that. That was such a cool place, you know, sitting in there. So anyhow, yeah, working with V and all of that. When you went from one show to the other, I know, did you work ever at the Greek Isle with that?
I sure did. World's Greatest Magic Show. I'd worked at, was it two or three different locations? It started off at the Sahara.
Yeah.
And they were very heavy on the union people, and Dick Feeney couldn't handle, you know, hiring two backstage supervisors which sat down and read a paper while the show went on. So it was one of those things, you know, where there's a dozen other people standing around not doing anything. It's like, look, we need three people. Why do we have 23?
Yeah.
You know, so it was one of those things that's why he moved on to another location.
Because I think you had told me towards the end of that, I mean, they kept paying less and less to the point that they just basically said, if you want to come and work for free and use Las Vegas as a credit, you can come and be in the show, kind of a thing.
Yeah, Las Vegas sort of got that way after a while. Well, you know, here's the thing, you know, way back in the 80s, you know, when Cirque started, that was sort of like the beginning of for entertainers. That wasn't a good thing because Cirque du Soleil, they got in, you know, all their acrobats from either Russia or China, and they were paid like $200 a week.
Wow.
You know, and
that's probably a lot of money for them, I guess, in
that
there.
They just wanted to work Vegas and have a great time, you know. And of course, they got it for real cheap. And then they figured, well, if all these great people are working for nothing, why not get the rest of the acts?
Uh-huh.
And we're offering less and less. And even Anthony Gatto, you know, the world's greatest juggler, in my opinion,
yeah,
and many other people's opinion, he was offered for God, it was probably 10 years. You know, hey, can you do Cirque du Soleil? And he's, how much money? And he goes, nope. And it took him 10 years to finally pay him enough money.
Mm-hmm.
That was his regular fee.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, he was and is certainly great and touring around. For a while, you also were doing cruise ships. And did you put together the Illusionarium? Was that what it was?
Yes.
Okay.
It was Norwegian Cruise Line that, matter of fact, Ron Wilson from the Magic Castle called me.
Yeah.
After I had been I haven't been in L.A. or there, and I've been in Vegas for years. And he says, hey, you know, Norwegian's asking for you to come back and headline this new ship. And I said, oh, all right. It's this big epic. And it was the largest cruise ship at the time. I got plenty of stories of that one if you want.
We got time.
I guess we do. But anyways, yeah. So I said, well, I don't know. What's the money? And then he quoted a fee that was even double what I would have charged. And I went, heck yeah, you know, let's mm-hmm. do it. So next thing you know, I'm there for a couple seasons. And then they come to me and say, the entertainment director said to me, hey, I want to pitch a new show. Do you have an idea for a show that's going to go into this circus environment, you know, around? And I said, yeah, give me a couple days. And within a couple days, I picked out the show, sent it to him, and he goes, wow, this is great. Yeah, let's do it. And so we got together storyboards and all this sort of stuff, and I pitched it. I wasn't even like maybe three pages into a 10-page script, and the owner of the company, the CEO, says, stop, we're going to do this. This is great. Okay. And I said, and I was sort of disappointed because I worked 6 months on this presentation. I wanted to go, no, shut up, people. I want to tell, you know. I go, no, you want to see these cool pictures? You know? And so finally I said, okay, alrighty then. Let's do it. But here's a good lesson for a lot of people in business. You know, I always, you know, we all know that sometimes if you don't charge enough, you're not worth it. You know, it's like if it's a cheap couple $100 magician, sometimes a company will go, no, you know, unless it's a good price, then they'll think you're worth it.
Right.
Well, I designed the show so that it wasn't that expensive. These special effects I knew that we could do with lighting and different type of special effects around the room. That would be relatively cheap. It wasn't really mechanically or, you know, otherwise tech heavy. Well, they said, well, no, we're going to do this, this, and this. We're going to get these mapping projectors that cost $50,000 a piece, and we need six of them. And we need this guy to come in and this company come in. We're going to spend $1 million on this. And I said, wow, really? I go, I already told you how to do it for $50,000, but if you want to spend $2.5 million,
wow.
I guess you can. It's, you know, whatever. And funny enough, on the first day of the show, one of the board of directors guy come up and goes, you know, I don't know about all this. I go, I think your idea was better. We should have stuck with the original idea. And I'm like, yeah, I know. And it wasn't as good. The $3 million job they did wasn't as good as my 50 grand job would have done. Funny. So just to let you know, sometimes money does not buy a good show.
Even if you have it, you shouldn't spend it.
Yeah, they could have tried mine first and been happy with it. But okay. Hmm. So anyways, that show did last. They said there was a 3 to 5 year lifespan on the show, just because that's what they do with shows, 3 to 5 years. And it lasted about 4.5 years. And then the ship that it was on, they repositioned to Europe where it was no English-speaking passengers, and so they cut out the show. Hmm. But it was a heck of a show. It was really fun. And one of these days, I've got the videos, and I'll show them. Not quite yet, but I've got all the versions where I brought in all the different magicians. And then I'll tell you the story about how I wrote the show, and then they rewrote it to put people in, and that's a whole nother thing. They put actors in that I didn't originally have.
Wait a minute. So you were the producer of the whole thing, and you, of course, had booked the acts to come in, and you were performing, I guess, kind of as the MC of the carnival.
Yeah, there's a character about the end, which I wrote, a grandson of a dead magician, and he appears as a skeleton. And he comes to life, right? Okay. And he basically, and we did that. But then they added all these other characters that I didn't have in there.
They being the ship, the Norwegian?
Well, the ship, because they bought the idea.
Uh-huh. And they're the ones paying for it, so they feel they can do anything they want.
So they could do that. I was not happy about it. And we argued, and it's just a regular thing. It's the process I call that. That's the word I hear in entertainment that I've learned, the process. Wait a minute. You just lost $1 million. It's part of the process. Oh, so that's the excuse to screw up. It's part of the process. So it still ended up being the number one show in the fleet, the best, scored show among the passengers. That's all they cared about. And we did better than all the other sort of like Jersey Boys type shows and everything. We had the most highest scores. And so I was real proud of it.
As I recall, didn't you swap out acts from time to time? It wasn't the same group of people the whole time.
No, matter of fact, it was my wife who, we met, the clairvoyance, mm-hmm. which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
Tommy and Emily. We met them in Germany, and my wife said, you know what? They would be good for the ship show, the illusion. And I didn't really know much about them, but she looked them up, and I sort of went, I'm not sure. I'm not so sure, but I took her advice, and sure enough, they were the hit of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And they sort of credit us in being their first venture into a United States performing facilities. So they were the first ones, and we had Sean Paul and Julianna Faye. We had Lossander, James DeMere, Alain New, Bruce Gold, and a host of others. So it was really a good show.
Yeah. I remember talking to you about that way back when, and it was and Tommy Tin and Emily were going to be moving on, and you said they're going to be looking for a mentalist and to perhaps put together something, and I was going to send you a video on that. Remember that?
Right.
And then after that all came about, then you say, well, it's a good thing that didn't work out because they didn't tell you, but apparently they were looking for someone exactly like the clairvoyance, the someone who was a two-person. They didn't want a mind reader or a mentalist. They wanted a two-person. They wanted a clone of them.
Well, once they got a taste of it,
yeah,
and there are, duo, there's great, the Evisons, there's a bunch of them,
yeah.
But for some reason they like the style, and there's a few things that Tommy and Emily have that nobody else has, just because they're different from a few other people. And so they really wanted to find somebody, but what they learned, is they couldn't, try and, they wanted to have acts and go, okay, can we just make a copy of that act? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, it doesn't quite work that way. In fact, it will never work that way. Now, there are copies. We've all seen copies of Lance Burton. We've seen copies of Jeff McBride. We've seen copies of Doug Henning way back in the day. But but no way. It just doesn't work. It never does. Never
right.
will.
Right. You have to have that it factor. You have to be a a character, a person, or an act, I guess, and which would differentiate. I mean, there is no other Jeff Hobson, there is no other Lance Burton. I mean, everyone is, people are trying to clone the success, and they think that the success is the act, and no, it is you, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and I think eventually people figure that out once they try it out. I've had, you know, I've had a number of people over the years, decades, come up to me and go, oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. You helped send me to college because I took your card mouth and all your lines and everything, and I studied it, and I did it at all these places. And I'm looking at them like, and I don't get why they think that that's a compliment. And I just went, I go, you owe me $10,000. You know, what? I go, well, you made money. You sent it through. I go, I think 10,000 is fair. And they all go, oh. They freak out. Oh, you know, they still don't get it, though.
No, that's true. I had things like that happen in one particular case. Actually had I was writing a book, Jamie Salinas and I, on a seance book, and we put them in lecture notes, and we were going to flesh them out, and we delivered this to the Mindvention, and someone then took those and made it a book and credited us and sent us free copies, said, thank you so much for the ideas, and copied it verbatim and everything and made that into a book and added some more things. It's kind of like, okay, you're welcome, but you owe me?
No, that's it. Well, yeah. Well, you know, here's the thing. I always say, when people don't get it, I go, look, I've got this really cool recipe that I made up for a cake. And the cake's great, and it's different from everybody else's, and it's yummy, and everybody loves it. Well, then you take that recipe, and all of a sudden you market it, and you make money on it. I go, wait a minute. That's my recipe. Yeah, the milk you can buy at the store, the sugar you can buy at the store, everything you can buy, but I put it together in this, which makes it a special thing that tastes different, and you just took it, and you're making money. I go, and so then they sort of go, oh, I see. Yeah, it's a recipe.
So. Someone left the cake out in the rain, and it took so long to make it.
You know what? I would never sing again, really.
That's it.
Don't ever do that.
That's it. That's it. Thank you. Good advice. Good advice.
And you just dated yourself, too. So.
Boy, did I. Well, going back, still along that line, I was thinking about the people who are the producers and telling you what to do and how the show should be written. And as I recall also that you had told me later, this is not my decision. I cannot hire you. I'd like to put you in. However, there are people who are actually the money behind it who are making the decisions. I can only put you in front of that. And I think a lot of times people don't recognize when they're trying to get booked for a show, they are talking to the wrong people. They may be, I mean, not yes. that I was talking to the wrong person being talked to you, but you were up front and saying, hey, I'm not the one, it's going to be somebody else, but I can't get to those people. And sometimes you can't, you have to have an agent or somebody else to
go
through.
And that's another factor of the Illusionarium is that, you know, I became, they made me the de facto agent to book these acts.
Yeah.
I have to, quote, submit them, and then they look at the video, and then they decide, their entertainment director goes yay or nay. Well, then it got to that point in their business model that they said, for whatever reason, could be a lot of different reasons, is they said, oh, we have to take multiple bids now from other agents.
Wow.
You know, you and who, and now we have to take at least three. So now there's a, so I'm like, well, you know, I go, wait a second, you've got success.
It was your idea.
You know, yeah, and I know all the acts, and I'm sure you got other agents that know the acts, but they don't know the show. They haven't seen the show, you know, and that was when it started to, that was after the third, going into the fourth year, and we could see it sort of crumbling, you know, and then too many cooks in the kitchen always ruins it.
Yeah, wow, interesting. Now, around that time, actually, prior to that time, is when you were actually doing Carnival of Wonders with Mark and Ginger, right?
Yes.
And although that started in Vegas, then went to Atlantic City, and where else did you go with that?
Well, we started in Atlantic City in two different places, Trump Marina and Trump Castle. Mm-hmm. Then I think we came back and did Caesar's Magical Empire. Then we went back out to – then we went to Reno – and we're at the Flamingo, and then we went to the large, ended up at the large one. What was that called? The Reno Hilton, which
Reno
is
Hilton.
Now Sierra.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was huge. That
That's
was
the largest stage in the country. I mean,
it was.
Put a 747 there.
Okay, here's a Here's an interesting story. So hardly anybody knows that on stage right, they built a two-bedroom apartment. Now, that's how big this stage is. Yeah. They actually built an apartment for Frank Sinatra on his last tour, because that's like one of the last places he played. Wow. And so he says, well, if I'm going to be there for whatever, a month or whatever it was, he wants an apartment built.
On stage.
On stage. So all he has to do is open the door and like 30 steps and he is on stage.
Wow.
Now, I had that room. That was my dressing room. And sure enough, it looked, you know, you're backstage all black, you know, and then you have a key and you open his door. And sure enough, you know, it's a room. It's a sofa. It's a TV. It's the whole room. It's the bedroom. It's the shower. It's it's everything's there. You would never know that you're backstage, right? No. Amazing. Amazing. And so I had that room. Now, that is, at the time, it was either the world's largest stage, second only to, I think it was Singapore or Shanghai, had just a little bit bigger of a stage, but pretty huge. Well, I was in costume, and it's the beginning of the Carnival of Wonders show on a particular night. And of course, like 10 minutes before the curtain goes up, I have to walk around the backstage off to the side. And it's like takes you a long time to walk it because it's just forever, right?
Yeah.
So now I realize as I'm about to go on, the overture's playing, and I realized I forgot my hat in the dressing room.
Oh, boy.
On the other side of the stage. And I realized that this special effect we're doing, we're rolling down a poster of me. I have to have that hat on or else it doesn't match. So I basically heard the overture, which lasts like a minute, and I said, oh, and yeah. I, you know, expletive.
Expletive.
So I'm like running like a bat out of hell all the way back. Go into the room, have to unlock it, grab that, run all the way around. I get to the place where I'm supposed to be, but now I am so out of breath, I'm supposed to be still and in a frozen position.
Yeah.
And also I'm going, and I'm sure from the front people going, wow, that poster's moving. I don't know what's going on, you know, but yeah, I've never been more panicked in my life on a stage cue than that one, but I'll remember it as long as I live.
I remember an MC one time, it was one of the funniest gags, who came in from stage right over there as they'd introduced him, and he was carrying a little lunch bag. And about halfway to the center, he stopped and opened up the bag and started eating the sandwich and put it back and then walked the rest of the way to center stage. It was so far to get there.
You're like, oh, yes, exactly, exactly.
Well, I had heard also, I believe, was it Mark Halen or someone who actually had like a 737 or some jet that was back behind there that they kept for a long time? I mean, they still had room for other kinds of stuff. He didn't have to move it. It's kind of like, okay, we'll get it some other year.
Okay, to be perfectly honest, it was a model of a 737 with shortened wings and shortened fuselage. So it wasn't a full-size plane, but yes, this was a big plane. Mm-hmm. And they used it for a show called, I believe it was Hallelujah Hollywood, mm-hmm. I think, which ran for 20-some-odd years at the Reno Hilton, where the finale of the show – they revealed this big plane and they had all the people inside dancing and, you know, the windows and the pilot, you know, the whole bit.
Yeah.
You know, that it was already there. So when I hope Mark will forgive me for this, but, you know, the idea of producing a plane where for 22 years people already knew it was backstage in a show, people really weren't that shocked. At the production of a plane that we go, oh, yeah, that plane, we saw that a couple years ago in a show here, you know.
It's still
so, you know, I think it was good for advertising. Sure. I think it was good for that sort of thing that, you know, but, yeah, it was an interesting time.
What happened to the Carnival of Wonders? Personally, I think that was one of my favorite touring shows ever, and I'm including Copperfield and others. You know, I'm sorry to other friends I may be dissing their show, but that was just delightful on so many different levels. It had a roller coaster of emotions. The illusions were mystical. I still have no idea how that curtain all went into your top hat at the end. I mean, all those kinds of things. It's like, this is a marvelous show. What happened to that?
Well, you know, it's like anything else. You know,
runs
a show has it running its time. We had our time, and then it tried to be, you know, even if something works, a show in a place for a while has to change. You know, they always have a different show. Mm-hmm. Entertainment's changed. You know, like I say, the Hallelujah Hollywood 22-year run. Wow, you could do that. Today, you couldn't do that.
Ah,
you couldn't
good have point. A, good point.
You know, you couldn't have a show that runs forever because it just people are want something different all the time now. Yeah. You're catering to people's, you know, 7-minute attention span or 7-second attention span. Mm-hmm. And so now we were at the cusp of the, sort of that thing where, okay, the show, good, it had its run, it's great. And we did revive it at a few casinos a few years later and a few years later. We did one in 2007 and another one in 2000, I think maybe 11, I think was 11, maybe, or maybe even later than that. And we did a few revivals of it, and it's fun. It was a very fun show. Our chemistry between the three of us were very balanced. You know, you had Wilma Jean, the damsel, and the funny guy, and it all did a, you know, and Mike Caveney sort of said it was a Leroy Tomlin Bosco sort of thing.
I'm just going to say, I couldn't say it fast enough. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so, you know, it was, I just think it was the right show, the right time, with the right chemistry. And we had, you know, guys that were very smart. And Joni Spina, you know, choreography, and she found most of the music, and which she's brilliant. She was brilliant at that. Mm-hmm. I miss her so much. And we had Alan Wakeling was one of our consultants.
Wow.
Jim Steinmeier was a writer. So, you know, when you put all the good stuff in a pot, that recipe thing I'm talking about, that's where you get a good show, when you put the right recipe together.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with a group like that. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's true. There is something I do need to ask, and that does a large part of your life. You're talking about The Illusionist, where most of the world knows you and had the opportunity to where you travel to see them rather than them coming to America to see the shows you've been in Vegas and Atlantic City, et cetera. And so you're going elsewhere. Was there any place that comes to mind that was really one of your favorite locations, shows you've done, places you've visited, maybe it was a museum or food or something that kind of comes to mind?
Yeah. Well, you're talking about on the Illusionist tour. Yeah. There's so many places that we toured.
Yeah.
And the problem with Europe, and it is what it is. We had to have a translator most of the time. Mm-hmm. So the shows really weren't as like they are in America, where everything's quick and you have to have that translation thing.
Good point.
I did have one translator that was a funny guy, and we had a blast where I would say something and then I'd cuss in their language and I'd, oh, that's wrong. What did I say? You know, and sort of make it. And so we had a lot. That was sort of like the special time of that tour, where you got to be family with people from all over the world. Translators and bus drivers and everybody, that you felt a camaraderie and making a show out of a difficult situation in many times. Now, of course, Carlo Vivari? I might be saying it wrong. It was in Czech, one of the most gorgeous places on the planet. I didn't even know it was there. I would go back just to see Carlo Vivari and perform there. It
was
just gorgeous.
You said it was Czechoslovakia, or where was it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Czech Republic now, whatever. Yeah. But yeah, that was one stop, and it was just gorgeous. So I remember that. I will remember that all my life, because it was like the one place you just were totally in awe the entire time. Just gorgeous. For best audiences, though, if you want to do that 7-year time, the best audiences were two cities. They were both in America, Costa Mesa, California, and Tampa Bay, Florida.
Okay.
Tampa.
I would not have guessed either one of those.
I would not have either, but the reason why I say that, we've been there now 2 or 3 times on tours, and each time it's more laughter, more applause, more appreciation than anywhere else we've been.
Why do you think that is?
I have no idea. I don't get it.
Because I've heard people say, for an example, in audiences in Minnesota, they know there's an audience out there because they cast a shadow. But whereas there are other players, but they just appreciate it in a different way. And so perhaps Tampa and Costa Mesa then also just appreciate it in their own way.
Yeah, they were very vocal and appreciative. And, you know, it's almost like when you write a script, they're supposed to applaud. They do. You know, it's like everything was done the way you think. The most difficult, most stressful time. This is one story that was a pretty good one. Broadway, opening night on Broadway, our first season, first time. Everyone, of course, is nervous.
Right.
I don't know I'm supposed to be nervous because I never thought as a magician, I'm going to perform on Broadway. What, it's just another gig?
Right.
But then it's sort of like sunk in. Oh, crap, this is Broadway. And we're opening night. Oh, this is important. Oh, and then you start getting a little bit nervous. And then you realize, oh, opening night. Also, all of the critics are sitting there. And they tell you where they're sitting. Oh, yeah, New York Times is there. And I'm like, oh. Well, we have this beautiful box that's like 12 feet long, 10 foot high, 10 foot deep, acrylic box that's hoisted up into the air. You can see through it. The lights are going through it. The dancers. This is the opening number, right? I'm not on stage. And the idea is that the curtain comes down sort of like the Siegfried and Roy tiger appearance.
Yep. From the ceiling.
The curtain comes down and then, boom, there's the whole cast is in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I appear going, "Love the Illusionist, ladies and gentlemen." And then I do my act and everyone crawls out of the box. Okay, that's the way it's supposed to go.
Yeah.
So now, da-da-da-da-da-da, and I'm backstage and I'm thinking to myself, gee, now, if anything goes wrong, I wonder what I should do. And it's a little bit late for me to be thinking this, but it's like the overture's going and the girls and boys are dancing underneath, and the box is da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I'm watching it just like everybody else in the audience going, oh, and then da-da-da-da-da, back! And the music stops, curtain doesn't drop, nothing happens.
Oops.
Just nothing. And it's silence. And nobody's moving. Nobody's doing anything. The audience is silent. And I just go, oh. And I talk to one of the backstage techs, and I know what's going on out there in the front. They're going nuts.
Yeah.
Right? They're going absolutely nuts. And I said to one of the techs, I go, tell the guys out front I'm going out now. Because I just went, you got to.
You got to.
So I walk out, it's silent, spot hits me, and I say, I don't even know why I thought it. I go, you know, if that trick would have worked, it would have been so cool. And everyone, I tell you, the New York audiences thought that they had been in a practical joke, and they all just roared and applauded and thought that was the greatest. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my gosh. And I just said, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Jeff Hobson. And I just started to act like I would normally.
Yeah.
Nobody knew any different. And all the owners just gave me the biggest hug afterwards because they went, you know, they're all like, oh, they're pulling out their hair.
They knew what was supposed to happen.
Yes. And so I guess something happened in the back of my head and just went, I'm going to say something. You know, I don't know. But that was probably one of the most stressful moments in my career happened in the Illusionist show.
Next to running and getting your hat.
And that was another one. I'm actually reliving this. My heart is tightening. I got to go.
Have you ever had celebrities or somebody that have come to your shows? And I'm talking about over your career in Vegas and around the world in different places that have kind of thrown you off a little bit. Someone's like, oh, my gosh, it's Pavarotti or whatever, you know, it's come to see.
We've had plenty of celebrities in there, especially in Broadway. We've had, you know, Woody Allen. Alan, all that, Driver Streisand, everybody shows up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're all there.
They come backstage, I guess, too?
Sometimes, yeah. Phil Collins, a few other people, they all come backstage. Woody Allen did. I opened for a lot of people, stars and stuff over the years, too.
Right.
I've never had a thing that threw me off. Audiences have thrown me off. Like somebody accidentally booked me for Jethro Tull as an opening act.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know the music of Jethro Tull.
That's an odd choice between you and...
I had no idea, but as soon as I walked, I almost got to the microphone, and more than that, a few people just said, get the F off stage, you know, before I even said anything.
Yeah.
And right there, you know, so working with in different you know, celebrities' audiences throw me off, but not the celebrities themselves.
Yeah, right. Before I forget about it, there was one little part also that few people know about nor remember, and that is what you and Michael Mode had put together many years ago was that app on Apple that was...
you could do it on, yeah, it was an iPad or iPod, or you could do it on your phone. Either one, it worked on any of those. It was called Best Jokes Ever.
Yeah. How'd you develop that? Talk a little bit about the development of that with you and Mike, Michael.
We went on, you know, Michael and I were always, we're sort of like, we like a lot of jokes, you know, we had a lot of books, and I had a massive library that I got rid of since then, but, and we're always calling each other with jokes, you know, and we looked online and I was trying to check out, you know, joke apps, and we're like, these are really bad. The jokes are bad. We know they're bad. So, and we realized that the vast majority of joke books and joke apps are written or compiled, rather, by people who really don't know how to tell a joke or really have not been on stage, you know, and know a good joke from a bad one just by reading it.
Yeah.
And so we said, boy, you know what? We know better what jokes are good and what aren't. So why don't we think about putting something together? And we found a developer and said, look, we want it this way, this way, this way. Can we put it all together? Michael and I spent about a year and a half compiling, writing this, all the jokes. And it was a great thing because you could search any joke. And there was three different levels. There was the clean and sort of like the iffy joke, PG. And then there was the dirty version we had, you know. But at least you knew what you were reading before you read it.
And different categories, like with medicine or doctors or...
Yes, and you could search any...
Golf
it was
or anything.
Searchable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so now we actually have it again.
Do you?
It's actually on... if you look up on the Apple Store, Best Jokes Ever... and look up Jeff Hobbs and Michael Mode, you'll find the actual PDF or the actual app where you can actually get it for, I think, a few dollars, $4 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing. You can actually search it, and it's now more in a little bit of a book form, a little more, you know, searchable and whatnot. But, yeah, and Michael wants to do a printed version of it as well.
Well, I was going to ask. I was trying to refresh my memory. As I recall, it wasn't someone telling a joke. You would actually read it. So in other words, you type in golf, and then you could read the joke. So it would be great for, like, MCs or whatever also.
Sure, and the thing is you could save it to favorites. So if you had, you know, look, you could do it in, like, a couple minutes, say, oh, I want jokes on sports, and you want, oh, I want that one, that one, that one, that one, and a list, it would have just those, so you can look at it and just have those jokes. It was brilliant, really was. It's sort of in that genre now. You can actually search for his favorite jokes.
Did you make any money off of it?
No, you know what? I think if I remember correctly, the development of the app at the time, the first one was like $7,000, and I think we made three.
Yeah, that's so, what I was thinking back then. It cost a lot because it was kind of on the front edge of all this thing and trying to get something. Yeah, I understand.
And then when you're an Apple developer, you've got the fees that you have to pay constantly to keep it up, and we're like, you know what? We're on to other things, both Mike and I, and we don't have time to keep that up, and so we just let it lapse until recently.
Now, that would have been, was it in the 90s or was that early 2000? I think 90s.
No, I think that was, I don't know now. I have to relook at that. I really think it was in the 2000s, I think. It was
back when iPad had the shuttle or shuffle thing, you know, that was, and for listening to music, you can only listen through it was before the iPad. What am I trying to say? That they had like an iPod, yeah, but it was just the iPod, just was music only kind of a thing, and there were some other...
iPod Shuffle or whatever, yeah, but you didn't have the screen. You had to have the screen for it, so...
Correct, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you had other kinds of projects and things that you were working on at the end of the time. And speaking of projects, then one of the things that I think is exciting, I didn't know that you were such good and close friends with Marvin Roy, which developed, I guess, later into Marvin's... What's the name of the club?
Marvin's Magic Theater.
Marvin's Magic Theater, which is in Santa Barbara, or where are you?
La Quinta, California, which has nothing to do with the hotel chain. Nothing to do with Denny's, nothing. La Quinta, California, and it's a part of the Palm Springs Coachella Valley. So if you're in Palm Springs, we're about 40 minutes from Palm Springs going toward Arizona.
Okay. And that was developed when and how?
Well, Gary Buettler, who is a marvelous person, a good friend that I've known for years. He was a friend, friend of magic. Talk about a guy who really needs his, his credit.
Yeah.
His credit is that he was one of the guys that started A1 Multimedia, which became A1 Magic Media, which of course started the trend with L&L almost at the same time. But he started that, and most of the lectures that are done through A1 Multimedia are done at one of Gary's houses. He's got this huge bar with people sat around. He did all the stuff, all the things there. That was with Mike Maxwell.
Right.
And he also then helped a number of other magic projects get up and running. And over the years, he always said to me, he goes, Jeff, if you ever want to open up a club or something, let me know. I'll help you. I'm like, oh, yeah. And I turned it down for like 11, 12 years just because I was doing stuff. I'm in Vegas. Well, why would I want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, a few years back, he mentioned it again. And I said, oh, okay, let me go find out what this La Quinta or Palm Springs is. So I came here and I went, wow, this is great. This is wonderful. It's a great location. And we looked around, found a place. And next thing you know, he said, okay, let's do this. And I'm like, okay, let's do this, I guess. And next thing you know, I was right at the tail end of doing 7 years with the Illusionist. I figured it coincided 7 years to the day, New Year's Eve, at the Sydney Opera House. I decided I started there 7 years, and 7 years later, I'm at the same spot. And I said, that's a good run.
Good bookends.
7 years, 7 years, Sydney Opera House. I go, that's good. I'm going to take a leave and do this. And so I've been here now for, going on a couple of years now, and getting the theater up running. And, we're number one on TripAdvisor. We're doing well, and people are all waiting for the fall to reopen again.
So is it similar to the Magic Island? By the way, it just occurred to me, Newport Beach was the name of the place, I believe.
Yes. Newport Beach, correct. Yeah.
So is this kind of like the venue there?
No, it's different. This is a very contemporary, newer looking location that just has a small fall magic shop where you come in and people are confused.
Mm-hmm.
Where they look, well, there's a little magic shop, It's like, 16 feet by 12 feet. That's it,
And, yeah.
And then all of a sudden it magically gets revealed into a bar. And then that bar finally you go, oh, this is where the show's at. I go, no. Go into the back and anywhere.
So it's kind of like a Chicago Magic Lounge with the laundromat in a way.
Sort of. It is in a way like that where you don't know where you're at first. I love the Chicago Magic Lounge, though, the fake laundromat. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, completely different. Obviously, going into a magic shop, you think the idea is, well, this is going to be magic as opposed to going into doing your laundry. I wonder how many people actually do carry baskets in there thinking, I'm going to try that laundromat. They just moved into the neighborhood. They go, wait a minute, this thing isn't working.
I don't know. Because it's quite realistic. Yeah. I mean, really, I guess it was a laundry at one time, right?
Correct. Yeah. And then they gutted it completely out of there. In yours, did you gut that and then build from that on up, or how would that?
This is part of a big, this is the busiest intersection in the entire Palm Springs Valley, Coachella
Wow.
Valley, where we're at. But there's so many stores and restaurants around, we can get lost. People are always looking, where are you located? Well, we're right down the hall from the Century Movie Theaters. And they go, oh, it's a storefront of a mall, which had nothing at it. It was just total concrete, nothing
mm-hmm.
there. It was a 12,000-foot golf center, huge, like the biggest in the entire valley. And we basically took 6,000 square foot, which I find out from Dale Heinemann. He says, it's bigger than the castle. I go, the castle's smaller than 6,000 square foot. He goes, yeah. I go, really? Yeah. I go, to me, the castle seems like it's a massive mansion. It
goes on and on. Yeah.
But it doesn't, when you think about it, the rooms are very small, very tiny, very crunched together.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that, but yeah, so we're just a hair bigger than the Magic Castle as far as square footage. And, and so we're, we got restaurants all around us, so we do well with that.
There's the other Magic Castle East or whatever it is that Milt Larson had built. Is that anywhere near you? Yeah. Santa Barbara. Okay. And that's a much smaller venue than than all of those. Okay. Yeah. So is yours also where you are doing all the booking to for people to coming in, or have you got an entertainment director or is handling that, or are you doing a little bit of everything?
No, I'm pretty much the multiple
Chief cook
guy.
And bottle washer, yeah.
I pretty much do everything. We hire, you know, we have a sound. I don't do sound or lights. I can do some of it. I'm not – we have actually quite advanced moving lights in here, and I wouldn't know how to – you know, I'm not a techie that way.
Yeah.
And so I have somebody else, luckily a few people in the Valley that are – we have a good theater, you know, crowd here that love its theater. And so it's not too hard to find people that are good at lighting sound. I could give you like an hour on how this place is built and how it started bigger and kept getting. And again, you know, we're sort of fighting with people that don't know theater. And so I'm saying, no, we need the seats this way. Well, no, they could be this way. I go, no, they got to be the, you know. Yeah. And so you're dealing with people that don't know theater. And this was like the first theater that a lot of people designed and built. And so you're sort of teaching them, hi, you know, there's a reason why you have it the way I'm telling you. And so finally, but with unfortunately, because of ADA regulations of how big bathrooms have to be,
right,
and what
we lost, wheelchair accessible and all that.
All that sort of stuff. We lost a lot of room that was officially drawn up by the architects. And here's the other thing. You know, the initial thing was, oh, yeah, we got one restroom out in the lobby. And I said, well, what about for the acts? What, the restrooms need an act backstage? I mean, the restrooms, you know.
Acts need a restroom, yeah.
Acts need a restroom backstage? What? And I go, yeah. And then my wife correctly said, well, we have men and women, so we need two restrooms backstage. And they all went, oh, no, you know, it was only, what are you talking about? And I go, no, it's true. And so now we get rave reviews from all the entertainers coming in saying, this is one of the best places because we got refrigerators in the room. This is like a real frickin' place to do a good show at.
Just so. One scale down from Frank Sinatra's stage right.
Yes. yeah. That was a nice room. I had a piano and everything. I love it.
So why name that after Marvin Roy? Marvin was a friend then of yours. I mean, of all the names you could have come up with.
Well, here's what. So we designed the place. It's in the workings. We haven't come up with the name yet. And I was thinking, you know, Palm Springs Magic Theater, La Quinta Magic, Variety Arts Theater. You know, all these names were coming to me. And the person, we have a local IBM SAM ring that's named after him. Mm. You know, it's the Marvin Roy ring.
Yeah.
And I got to know Marvin really well, and we're going out to dinner, and he's very excited that a new place is going to be built. Oh, this is going to be great. And he's, oh, we'll be able to have steak dinners at midnight. And I'm thinking, he's thinking 1950s cabaret in Europe. And I'm trying to let him down nicely that, no, oh, you're going to have the big orchestras with the trombones. I go, no, but keep on that track, you know, whatever. Yeah. So unfortunately, we couldn't, you know, that's a whole nother story about when he first saw the place. That's pretty funny. And I lost my track. Where was I?
About why and how you named it Marvin.
Yeah. So one day we're from Gary. Gary says, I know what we're going to call it. And I said, what? He goes, Marvin's. And I went, of course, that's what we're going to call it.
Yeah.
Marvin's Magic Theater. And so it just one day we went, yeah, hell yeah. The whole thing is now, you know, sort of like electrical sort of themed up in the front and whatnot. And we show videos of Marvin before show, and we show his photos out in the lobby. And yeah. And so it's an homage to Marvin, and that's his seat right there. I see it. And he sat at all the time on a Sunday afternoon. He loved it.
A real tribute to him. All right. Well, yeah. I do want to hear that story though, about when he first came to see the place.
Okay. So, we have a huge photo of Marvin when the door opens. I mean, it's 12 foot tall. So, I mean, you can't miss it.
Billboard
it takes
size.
The whole room, right? And then on the opposite wall is Carol.
Okay.
In the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Single photo of her.
Okay.
So he comes in and he doesn't say anything about the place, but he makes a beeline to that picture and he says, that was taken in 1974 by blow. And he goes on for 10 minutes about that photo, but nothing about the place.
Okay.
Okay. And then I turn around and I point to the picture of Carol and I say, look. And he goes up to him and goes, who's that? And here's the thing. It wasn't because he really didn't recognize her. It's because I photoshopped the background out of it.
Oh.
So he saw the photo and didn't recognize the overall photo. But he still said, who's – it threw him off.
He couldn't place it.
I said, that's Carol. He goes, no, it's not. I go, yeah. I said, I sort of fixed up the hair. And it's Carol. It's Carol. So, you know, I think I just threw him off. And yeah. He was sort of out of his element where he was expecting one type of club. And he got totally 180. And then after the show, the first opening night, he's walking out and he hasn't said anything. You know, about the place yet. And I said, Marvin, so what do you think? And he put his hand on my shoulder. He goes, Jeffrey, he says, it needs a little sizzle. And I said, Marvin, I don't even know what that means. What does that mean? You know, I don't know. But finally he got over the shock of it not being Red Velvet, crushed Red Velvet, a band, and
from the 70s, yeah.
Something for out of the 70s or 60s or 50s. And he finally went, oh, yeah, this is a nice place. And then he loved it, you know. So, but it was interesting. The guy's not – was 94 at the time.
Yeah.
He's got a right to think however he wants to think and say whatever he wants to say.
He's been there, seen it, and done it all around the world.
Yeah, and we love him for it. And believe me, every day he came in, he sat – we have a place called Marvin's Corners here. He sits down, tables all around, and then I make the announcement. I go, by the way, Marvin, you're wondering who Marvin? See that picture? That's 1976. That's Marvin over in the corner. Everyone goes, oh, you know, he's on the Ed Sullivan Show twice and Johnny Carson and the Tonight Show. And he loved the attention. He just loved it. And so I think he went out with a smile on his face.
I think one of the funny things is it just occurred to me then also about the relationship where he, of course, later did the Magic Jeweler for Liberace, and you do Liberace type of stuff. So he had to love you for that.
I think that's where they – back in the 80s when we met, I think that's where they sort of fell in love with me because I was doing the, you know, hi, how are you? Isn't this wonderful? Yeah, you know, that sort of thing. So and we've been friends ever since 1988. So it was great.
Well, listen, as we wrap up, then the name of my podcast is called the Magic Word Podcast, and I'm always curious to know what it is that is the philosophy of life. What do my guests live by? What's important? Not necessarily a word. I don't mean like abracadabra, of course. I just mean like, and it doesn't have to be a word. It could be a sentence, a phrase, just a mantra, something that is important to you. It could be something important today that wasn't yesterday. I mean, when you wake up, what keeps you going?
Well, here's the thing that it's a cliche, but sometimes cliches are cliches because they're, you know, they've proven to be true. Mm-hmm. And be true to yourself. So many people, they look in the mirror and they think they're looking at somebody different, or they think they're somebody that they're not. Mm-hmm. Best thing you can do is to go, you know what? I don't have this talent. I don't have this. I don't look like that. Let's get down to real. What are my pluses? And be true to that. And once you really get down to a human, show that you're human and that sort of thing, I think, and the reality of who you are, and accept it and enjoy it and mm-hmm. be happy with it, I think the world would be a much better place for everybody to interact with.
Good way of looking at life. That's great. Jeff, thanks very much. I appreciate you being my guest. This has been just fantastic. It's been way too long for catching up here.
It is my honor. I love you. This is great.
So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Jeff Hobson. Scotty out.
Wow, what fun that was. Thank you very much, Jeff, for being my guest and for being my friend for so many years, and I look forward to us enjoying many more years to come. I know you have been interviewed and had conversations with other people on television, podcasts, and elsewhere, and you've covered a lot of other areas, but one of the things I wanted to do with this episode was to really look into you and personally and some of the things that are uniquely yours and perhaps some things that you haven't discussed elsewhere on other episodes or other podcasts and interviews and whatnot. So if you listeners are wanting to hear another side of Jeff and why he does what he does, or how he came about with what he does, or the secrets to his success and other kinds of things. You could probably catch that somewhere else. But I think there were some tips he gave during this that perhaps might have revealed some of those things then as well. So anyhow, thank you very much, Jeff. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in again this week to hear another great episode here with the Magic Word Podcast and with my buddy Jeff Hobson. I also want to remind you, if you want a little bit more content, please visit youtube.com/TexasMagician and watch this week's episode, because in the last 5 or 10 minutes of the video, he actually gives us a video tour of Marvin's Magic Theater. As we were recording this, he was sitting in the theater, and after it was over, he gave us a little bit of a bonus tour. So if you've already been listening to this in your car or in the gym, or as you're walking your dog, or however you might listen to these audio podcasts, you might want to go over and check out the video side of this, at least for the last 10 minutes, to see what his theater actually looks like. It's pretty darn cool. So go over there and check that out. Again, that's at youtube.com/TexasMagician. Or if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com for this week's episode, you will see a link there where you can click on that to go to view the video directly on YouTube. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to be true to yourself. This is Scotty out.